Synergy loves company.
With activations across our Synergy machine.
We have this coterie of rich franchises, the company now, that people want to engage with.
I came here to try and continue what Walt Disney and his associates set in motion 50 years ago, which is to experiment with every new and innovative kind of entertainment possible.
It's what we hope to do here, to really develop something that well, it's just more than an entertainment enterprise. It's something that contributes in many other ways.
Hey, this is Synergy Loves Company, where Disney connects to everything. I'm Eric Hathorn, and keeping me company today is Adam Ebert, fresh off the panels at C2E2 in Chicago and from other Comic-Cons across America, we'll say. So, Adam, how are you doing today?
I'm doing really well, Eric. How are you?
Pretty good. So I didn't bring you here just to, you know, shoot the breeze. We want to talk about Disney, and we want to talk about Marvel Comics. In kind of some weird and interesting ways. So I got to ask the first questions. We'll start with your Disney fandom. It's a Disney show. So tell me a little bit about what kind of Disney fan you are.
So, you know, I am adjacent to a massive Disney fan. My wife, your sister,
yes,
is a massive Disney fan. And, you know, I was never shy to anything Disney. You know, I was always particularly, you know, especially in the 90s, with the Musker and Clemens and just the, you know, Katzenberg doing everything he could and kind of revamping that, you know, the animation from Great Mouse Detective in the late 80s,
nice,
to Little Mermaid to Aladdin. Like, I was all big on those. My personal favorite was always Hercules.
Nice.
But then obviously I think, you know, the kind of the big moment for me was Toy Story, in which you got to see some Synergy. I remember the big thing for,
yes,
me with Toy Story was the Burger King tie-ins, in which you could get like puppets and kind of like little dolls that were Toy Story. So, you know, that just kind of bred of, you know, from one Disney thing into the next. And then, you know, kind of, I'm trying to think like into, you know, the middle school and high school years, that it kind of dried out with the exception of the Pixar, which I was just so engrossed in, and every, you know, the DVDs, just like rife with really good, behind the scenes material, which I just love just to see like into the creative process and the technological processes of, filmmaking and storytelling at Pixar. So, and then, you know, coming back around to it, you know, just like I said, through my wife rediscovering, you know, we went on our honeymoon to Disneyland, and then shortly, nice, after we went to Disney World. So, just, you know, gaining a deeper appreciation for everything Disney, and, you know, really again coming at Disney through the content, but, you know, having a better appreciation through it by actually going to the parks and seeing what the parks are all about. And, you know, just that whole, it's can be overwhelming, but I think in a really good way.
Indeed.
When you're going to the parks.
Yeah, no,
yeah.
It's all great. And some of those things you talked about with that early, or that kind of the resurgence in animation of the 90s. And that's, I think, a big, touchstone for a lot, touchstone, pardon the pun there, but, for a lot of people, kind of who came up through the 90s and enjoyed that stuff. And so, like, that's grown up in the 90s, and Disney and, of course, Marvel. That's when I read my first Marvel comic books, was in the 90s. So we're going to talk about Disney and Marvel a little bit today. So you have probably a better grasp on the Marvel fandom world than I do, because, like I said, you do the convention panels and things like that. So tell us a little bit about your Marvel experiences.
Yeah, I mean, from, you know, probably even before actually picking up books, you know, the Spider-Man and X-Men cartoons from the early 90s, I think, you know, were bringing a lot of fans to just those characters. But, you know, you had the crossover of, you know, obviously massive amounts of action figures for both of those properties, for X-Men in particular, the kind of early 90s overlap of you can go get a VHS with multiple episodes of X-Men from Pizza Hut with your book it personal pan. So, you know, they knew how to kind of get you however they could, which I think that's mainly like Toy Biz and Marvel Entertainment, which we can maybe talk a little bit about Toy Biz in terms of how Marvel and film properties and things moved around. But Toy Biz definitely knew how to, you know, cast a wide net with, and Marvel doing the same thing with, you know, you're going to get as many action figures as you want. You can, it's going to show up at Pizza Hut or some other restaurant and you're going to watch it on TV. And even again, you know, that would have been around the same time that that Jim Lee, Chris Claremont, X-Men number one comes out and it's the best-selling comic book of all time. It might still be.
Wow.
There might be some Disney Marvel padding of numbers in more contemporary times that might outdo it, but I think there's still more X-Men number ones hanging around.
Out there,
so
wow.
Yeah, and then just from there, you know, always wavered. I think you know, with comics for me, it's you know, come one, come all. I never really prefer Marvel or DC. It's usually just who is producing better comics and better content and media at the time. But, you know, just always trying to find as much as many stories and absorb, you know, the cream of the crop and the canonical stories, and trying to see what, you know, as they're making movies and TV shows, you know, they're always informed by books. So trying to make sure those I've read those books, and when I've read those books before they announce the thing, I feel that much more proud that I've read them before.
Nice,
they,
yeah.
Before they become a thing.
Well, and that's bringing up those canonical books. Of course, Marvel has tapped into a lot of those for the MCU. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of those things coming up. But what I wanted to talk about first, because maybe someone listening to our show would not be as into Marvel as Disney. They might be bigger Disney fans. And I wanted to talk about kind of a really... well, let's talk about first... I'm jumping the gun here. Let's talk about first kind of that moment when Marvel got acquired by Disney. When Disney takes over Marvel, and how that started. In my opinion, it seems to have come kind of out of left field. Because we talked a little bit before, trying to think back. I don't know that Disney had touched anything Marvel kind of in history until they acquired Marvel in 2009.
Yeah, and, you know, Marvel had been in some turmoil in the 90s. They were stretching themselves really thin. The comics industry in general was in dire straits because they were trying to, you know, as we said, with the Jim Lee and Chris Claremont X-Men number one, novelty covers and novelty stories were big just to push books without really producing anything of true quality. Marvel was filing bankruptcy in the late 90s. So they were very close to, one, not having a lot of cultural cachet, despite, you know, maybe some video games and cartoons.
Yeah.
But they weren't in the main public consciousness because there weren't movies. And, you know, if you're looking at the late 90s, the superhero content would have been Batman and Robin, which was seen as kind of a, you know, a scourge and, yeah, and shame being brought to these superhero stories. But what brings Marvel back is I believe they eventually get bought out by Toy Biz, a toy company. And I believe that's how we still get two big names, Ike Perlmutter, who's still the, I believe, CEO and owner of Marvel. And Avi Arad, who is he started at Toy Biz, but he became a prominent movie producer for the Spider-Man franchise, for the X-Men franchise, I think in its early iterations. And so they became these two figureheads who saved Marvel from bankruptcy. They put the right names in the right places, particularly the editor, Joe Quesada, who just recently left Marvel.
Okay.
Along with some other editors, Axel Alonso and Bill Gemmis. Those three in particular are responsible for bringing major characters back to prominence and teaming them up with creators of prominence. So that's how we get Kevin Smith on Daredevil, and that's how we get Joe Quesada, I believe, was drawing that book. They started that with an imprint called Marvel Knights. That has a lot of success, and I think that's the big reason that Quesada gets promoted to editor or editor-in-chief of Marvel. But I think they just basically look at all of the characters, and they see Blade is a successful film, X-Men and Spider-Man are franchises that are just about to come out in the early 2000s, and they're going, we need to bring these characters into the 21st century. So in bringing bigger talent from usually independent comics publishers, they go, how can we revamp these characters? Because there's going to be a lot more eyes on them as they're becoming film franchises. So we also see things like the Ultimate Universe springing up, which kind of rebooted, separate from the main Marvel universe, but rebooting particularly X-Men and Spider-Man at first to attract those people who, hey, I just saw Spider-Man in the theater, but I don't necessarily want to read, 40 years of Spider-Man. I'm going to pick up this book that's fresh. That brings a lot of success to Marvel. They crawl out of bankruptcy. A lot of those early books in the early 2000s, they're attracting a lot of talent. They're selling really well. And that, again, with in particular the X-Men and the Spider-Man franchises, brings them into the cultural consciousness and say, hey, this is a viable brand, and kind of saves them. So, kind of the right mix of business people, creators, and film franchises kind of brought them out of bankruptcy.
Kind of getting that right combination together.
Yeah. And, in particular, Disney, I know Disney, I believe that the idea of buying Marvel was floated to some shareholders and Michael Eisner, who would have been the CEO at the time. And those characters were deemed either too edgy for the Disney brand. So, maybe Eisner didn't want Wolverine hand in hand with Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
But it was something that I'm sure was floated, just as I'm sure, maybe Eisner wanted to get his hands on everything he could, right? He got the Muppets, but he couldn't get Sesame Street.
Right.
Certain things he really wanted there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, in saying, well, how can we, a much bigger company than Marvel. So, how can we acquire things? That gets tabled. But, as you look at the books coming, 2000s, kind of everything explodes with the internet. And so the film franchises are doing really well. Video games, the comic books are doing really well. The shows are continuing to be pretty successful. And I think, Disney is maybe making that connection of some of our live action output is struggling. And I even mentioned, and as a middle schooler and a high schooler, kind of really being into Pixar, but not really being interested in anything else Disney related. So I think Bob Iger, when he comes in, he goes, well, we want to be appealing to, we have the princess side, but we want to appeal more to the male side. And, it seemed like there were attempts. Tarzan, I think, is an attempt.
For sure.
Hercules is that attempt. Hunchback of Notre Dame is maybe an attempt. I remember I was really into it when I was a kid, and I haven't revisited it.
It was definitely an attempt to try to win an Oscar, for sure. No. Trying to do that kind of high art there.
Yeah, and so I think, Iger, he definitely teams up with Steve Jobs just to make the Pixar sale official, because he goes, well, who who are the characters that people really are, you know, resonating towards or gravitating towards in the Pixar characters. So a clear decision there. And I'm sure he's going, well, what's the next thing? How do we get, again, the boys into the Disney store? And how do we put that maybe merchandise in the Disney store for the boys? And Marvel was the connection. So in 2009, some of their input in terms of films is looks much different. And that's something I kind of want to bring up. In 2009, sure. You know, we're seeing 2007, going back a little bit, we see the conclusion, or so they said, of the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise, which is a big four quadrant film for them. But in terms of 2009, let me mention some of the live action.
Yeah.
We have, and this is from Touchstone and Disney proper, but we have Confessions of a Shopaholic, which is
romantic comedy.
We have Race to Witch Mountain with The Rock.
Yes, which is a continuation of the Witch Mountain movies from the 70s. So still, yeah.
Yes. We have The Proposal with Ryan Reynolds. We have G-Force, which I think is a combination.
It's like gerbils, right? Isn't it like gerbils that talk or something like that? Yes.
And then to wrap up, we have Surrogates, which is an adaptation. It's a Touchstone adaptation of a graphic novel
starring
Bruce Willis. And we have the film Old Dogs with John Travolta and Robin Williams, which is pretty bad.
Yes.
So that's their, you know, and obviously the Pirates franchise was massive, but they didn't have a lot else going for them around that time. And I think somewhere shortly after 2009, we get the Sorcerers. You know, we get things like National Treasure,
yes,
and the adaptation of the Sorcerer's Apprentice. But there's not a lot that people are gravitating. I think, you know, the National Treasure films would have been, you know, decent hits, modest hits,
right?
But nothing that is
nothing
bringing
caught
people.
Fire like Pirates had.
No, so I think they go, well, you know, we got to do something. We need something, and 2009, they acquire Marvel. They buy it for, you know, billions of dollars, if I'm not mistaken. And obviously, we have a lot of things in motion from the Marvel Studios side in terms of live action IP. The year before 2008, Iron Man is released. Iron Man 2 is probably in production, if not in post-production, by the end of 2009 for release in 2010. And then probably being pushed into production, we have Captain America, The First Avenger, and Thor, which I believe those are produced. All four of those films that I just mentioned are produced by Paramount.
Right.
As are the 2010 or 2012 and 2013 Avengers and Iron Man 3, which are produced, have Paramount logos at the beginning.
I can attest to that.
But are released officially by Disney. So, and that's where where it's kind of official. Now, the thing I want to bring up is 2009, we mentioned all those live action films. In 2019, so jumping kind of close to the end of Bob Iger's tenure.
Right.
I think six of the top 10 of the global box office is Disney. And their output in 2019 is the culmination of the MCU at the time. Avengers Endgame, the live action Aladdin, Toy Story 4, Lion King, Maleficent 2, Frozen 2, and Star Wars Episode 9. So they, you know, kind of exploded. And, you know, that's, I think, just a testament to Iger's, you know, acumen as a business person and making these connections and pushing these things to the forefront. But, you know, a movie that made like $2.5 billion just 10 years after the acquisition of those characters, I think just shows how wise of a decision it was for Iger. And, you know, Marvel and Star Wars, those acquisitions go hand in hand. But the output from Disney in terms of Marvel content is obviously a much bigger cast of characters and stories, and stories to pull from than Star Wars, but you know, there's been an explosion and they've owned it for longer. So
yes.
Now the other thing to consider right. is as they buy Marvel Comics or Marvel Entertainment in 2009, characters like Daredevil, Luke Cage, the X-Men, the Fantastic Four, even the Hulk are kind of owned or co-owned by completely different film studios.
Right. So
I think they've just about got everyone back. I think Hulk, we won't be able to see another Hulk standalone movie because Universal owns the film rights to okay. a solo, which I forgot in the, that's also 2008 Incredible Hulk, but that's owned by Universal. They don't want to let it go. And so that's why we mainly see Bruce Banner and the Hulk show up as a supporting character in the Avengers or She-Hulk. And we don't have an official Hulk. We don't have an official Hulk movie because it would have to be produced by Universal, which Disney doesn't like. Or I know Guillermo del Toro, the director, was developing a Hulk property for ABC in the mid-2010s. So
now would the TV be separate from the movie? Like, could they go TV?
That depends. That's probably a lot of untangling. But right. usually for live action TV, they might, but I think a lot of times they, you know, don't want to have their main characters starring in live action shows. Right. Even if you look at DC, Smallville, they didn't want to do a Superman show. They wanted to do a prequel, and
Young
Batman's
Superman,
never
yeah.
showed up on the CW in full.
Right. It's always been those kind of offshoot Birds of Prey type situations.
They don't want to have the main characters on TV because I think both companies, DC and Marvel, see that as lessening those film appearances. They feel like these are our big characters. They deserve to be on the big screen. So where Marvel, I think, owns all of their characters from 2009 is in animation.
Okay. So that's where you get those shows.
That's where, you know, the Fantastic yeah. Four can show up on Earth's Mightiest Heroes. They can show up, I'm sure, in some capacity on, you know, in little anime things or direct-to-video things. And
gotcha.
I think that's where Marvel Animation is much more tied into Disney.
Gotcha. Nice. So, yeah, that's a big... getting Marvel was a big thing, and it's still kind of a complicated beast in that, like you were talking about, trying to acquire, even though they bought Marvel, they still had film rights that belonged to other studios. Spider-Man still kind of tied up in that with how they work with yep. Sony. And even at Universal Studios, they've got all the Islands of Adventure, superhero island stuff that's hard for them to try to incorporate the Marvel characters in the Disney parks in Florida, for sure. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to get into some kind of maybe a little more strange, off the beaten path, Marvel Disney synergy opportunities where the comics and the Disney company come together. So the first one I want to talk about is kind of an opportunity that came. The idea started early on when Marvel and Disney started talking to each other, was to bring the Disney parks into comic books. And they were able to develop the Disney Kingdom series. And I'm going to kind of run through some of the titles that they did and some of the attractions that were made into comic books. And then maybe we'll talk about a little bit about like the people who made them come together and some of those things. So the first one they did, which is kind of weird, is The Seekers of the Weird. And it's based on the Museum of the Weird, which is an unbuilt attraction. It's a walkthrough that was kind of an idea that they were working through. Imagineer Rolly Crump had this idea, had a lot of ideas to put into this. Eventually, the Museum of the Weird becomes the Haunted Mansion. But the Seekers of the Weird is kind of like an adventurous group who are looking for weird things to like bring back to the museum, and this is the first one, which is kind of a, it was kind of like it didn't scream Disney parks. But then we get into some big ones that I'll kind of run through real quick here. We've got Figment, which is so popular that it gets a second run in the kind of short, they kind of had like a five or so issue run for each of these. But Figment does get a second one. Big Thunder Mountain gets one for Big Thunder Mountain Railroad. The Haunted Mansion gets its own, even though Secrets of the Weird happen. And Enchanted Tiki Room gets its own. So a lot of these are those big classic attractions. A lot of them go back very many years. We got the Epcot Connection, Disneyland, Magic Kingdom stuff. It's all kind of coming together there. And it's kind of an interesting take because this is only a few years after Disney takes over Marvel, and they put these out. The Figment ones were fairly popular, but I'm not too sure that a lot of the other ones were that popular other than to big Disney Parks fans.
Sure. I think, you know, something that we saw pop up in the Disney gift shops on the parks property is you can go, particularly in, you know, areas like Star Wars Launch Bay, and I'm sure in the gift shops of a lot of these rides, they have either the single issues or the trades of these Marvel books. And I think it's a really interesting idea. A lot of those names that pop up, people like Jim Zub on the Figment book, Dennis Hopeless on Big Thunder Mountain, Josh Williamson, those are prominent writers. Particularly Jim Zub is someone who has done Dungeons and Dragons, a property where, hey, you are the Dungeons and Dragons guy. I know he's done some Rick and Morty Dungeons and Dragons. But you know, Josh Williamson on Haunted Mansion, he, since 2016 when that book came out, he's like one of the top guys at DC. He was writing The Flash for a really long time after their 2016 reboot of their universe. And now he's writing, I think, their big crossover, which is called Dark Crisis on Infinite Earths. So he's someone who, you know, I think all of those guys would have been, you know, not big creative names, but
at the time,
you know, they're the trusted bullpen of writers and creators. And all of those books, I've read a couple. I think I've taken a breeze through the Big Thunder Mountain, and I have, I believe, the first few issues of the Figment. It is this really synergistic idea of, hey, I don't think we're ever going to get a Figment show or a Figment movie a la Pirates of the Caribbean.
Right.
But there is a mythology here that we can play on. Definitely Seekers of the Weird is a deep cut, but
it is.
Sometimes it is low investment to explore an idea and to kind of expand on these ideas. So you're expanding on the you know, mythology of these rides in the same way that the Gore Verbinski Pirates movie does. And you're letting people who, you know, as you and I both know, there are these deep fandoms for these rides. And
oh, yeah.
And there is plenty of history and, like I said, mythology built into these rides. And so I think this is a really interesting way of using Marvel Comics as an entity to flesh out some of the stories in a pretty low cost way. You know, again, much more cost productive than a cartoon or a movie that might be hundreds of millions of dollars to produce, like the, you know, and some of those haven't been successful. The Haunted Mansion with Eddie Murphy.
Right.
I think, has there been one, Mission to Mars, but I think Mission to Mars, there's a little bit of, a little hazy on how much of that is an adaptation and how much of it isn't. So,
it's right.
But, you know, an interesting idea and, you know, an early and quick and cheap way to use this new entertainment, company they bought.
Right. No. And so it ran from 2014 to 2017, kind of through these. I had read that they did have bigger plans to kind of keep going with this. They haven't put anything out since 2017. But one of the thoughts was that they would kind of make like a Disney Kingdoms universe where all of these were kind of happening in the same in the same world to kind of tie them together, which I kind of wish I could have seen that that come to fruition, because I think that would be cool. I'm going to kind of put you on the spot. Well, you got something there?
So yeah. The additional kind of thing, and this ties into not necessarily the you know, Marvel, but I believe 2015, two creators, Jason Aaron, who's one of the bigger writers at Marvel now, and John Cassaday, who is kind of, you know, one of their superstar artists, they relaunch Star Wars number one. Now, Star Wars as a comics property had been at Dark Horse Comics. And I believe maybe the license lapsed because I think it might be part of it might be going back to Dark Horse. I don't know. Well, I might be wrong there. But in, I believe, 2014, 2015, it goes from Dark Horse to Marvel. And so Marvel Comics is owned by Disney. Lucasfilm and Star Wars is owned by Disney. So they say, hey, we're doing the main Star Wars book. It takes place in between A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back. And then they've exploded. They've had, you know, Darth Vader comics, characters like Dr. Aphra, who I think is, you know, just a, you know, going to show up, I think, pretty soon somewhere, is introduced to the Marvel comics. Black Chrysanthemum, who showed up on Book of Boba Fett, gets introduced in some of those books. And they've jumped around to different time periods. But the main Star Wars book is usually... it started off as in between New Hope and Empire, and then I think at some point they relaunch with a new number one, and this one is in between Empire and Return of the Jedi. So, you know, they're bringing all these things together, and I think that's not necessarily a big Disney push, but I think, you know, money talks, and if Disney had the money with Marvel to be like, hey, we're buying that license because it's up. I think that's just where they are making the good and quick connections and using the capital they have to bring it into some nice synergy.
I will say too, when you brought that up, it reminded me. So I had my Disney Kingdoms books out here, but I forgot that I have a Marvel Star Wars Galaxy's Edge graphic novel also, which kind of brings that stuff all, like what you talked about, bringing that Star Wars world back in with Marvel and Disney, and that even brings it then back to the parks. So it's happening. It's not happening maybe with the Disney Kingdom series, but it's happening in some other ways that they're still kind of leveraging all of those properties together. Yeah. And that's
and
pretty
just,
cool.
You know, a character gets introduced in a comic and then shows up on the Disney Plus series and, you know, then might show up in the Galaxy's Edge tie-in comic. I think that's where you just have these opportunities that couldn't exist otherwise, because, you know, maybe Lucasfilm didn't want to play very nice with Dark Horse, but when they're all under the same umbrella, you get a lot of that connectivity and you get a lot of those. Yep.
That's nice. No, that's a good point too. To bring that up, I was going to ask you too. I was going to say, are there any other like Disney parks properties that you would see becoming Marvel Comics? But I think you kind of hit it with the Star Wars there, because that kind of did come in, especially because there is so much IP coming into the parks. A lot of things coming from the movies that are like, if you take something and put it from Marvel Comics into the parks and then you make a comic book of it, it still goes back to that comic book source material.
Mm-hmm. I still think there's, you know, great opportunities in what's the book series, Kingdom Keepers.
Oh, the like, for sure.
You know, where again, that can exist. Marvel's not very good at doing graphic novels, and attacking that, you know, YA graphic novel market. You know, they're mainly interested in like the, you know, we are getting your single issues, you know, we're not producing something that here's the whole story. But I think Kingdom Keepers, and I mean, you look at just the, you know, all of the different worlds that are present in those parks. And I think, you know, I'm trying to rack my brain. I think just the idea of Epcot, I think you could do, you know, Walt's original idea of what Epcot could be, I think has a lot of potential. And yeah, just,
yeah,
how much you want to, how much maybe they want to, you know, give some leeway and be like, hey, I want to tell a story in like Tomorrowland, right? Tomorrowland, you know, I think there's a lot of interesting ideas there of how can we do something that's very Epcot related, telling an interesting story that's a utopian side, because a lot of times we do lean into dystopia.
For sure.
You know, I think that escapism would be nice of here's what this, you know, perfect utopian society that, you know, maybe there's an outlier who creates some conflict and that drives the narrative. But I think there's a lot of potential in Epcot as something that hasn't got mined or something that doesn't already have its history from, you know, like Seven Dwarfs Mine Train or, you know, Peter Pan.
Right.
Like all of those are based in stories. But there's a lot of original things. And I think Epcot is just rife for...
Oh, no, totally. That's a good one to bring. That's a good one to bring to the table for sure. Epcot, especially going back to if you were to approach it from Walt's original plan too, and kind of go that route. There's a lot of different ways that could go. No,
and so, even like a cartoon set in Epcot would be cool, or like a book set in Epcot where it's just these are the adventures of these characters, and it doesn't need to be like this is a utopian society that will eventually get ruined somehow. Like they just live in a more perfect world that's equal, and you know,
that's really neat. So we talked a little bit about how Disney was incorporated into Marvel Comics, but I want to talk about a way where Marvel Comics was incorporated into a Disney animated feature, and that's with Big Hero 6. And a lot of people listening might not know that Big Hero 6, or not think of Big Hero 6 as a Marvel intellectual property, but it totally is. And I wanted to see if you could tell us a little bit about like where that comes from, what that's all about in Marvel terms.
Yeah, so you know, we talked a little bit about, you know, when Disney acquired Marvel in 2009, I think people were immediately expecting things to be in development and things to kind of switch over to Disney pretty instantly, which we're also seeing now with the 20th Century Fox acquisition, that it's not, those characters aren't getting, the Fox characters aren't getting integrated right away. It's taken time, and I think there's still some contractual things. So, you know, there are still Paramount logos in front of Avengers and Thor, and I don't
know if
maybe...
Those Iron Man movies?
Yeah, the Iron Man movies. So still, it took, you know, about 3 or 4 years to really get integrated. I think merchandise probably hit earlier, but the big thing, and it's funny when you would have seen that headline, Disney Animation Studios adapting Marvel comic, and you go, oh man, what would they be adapting, you know?
Right.
Would they be doing... you know, any number of things. And then you know you'd open that article and you'd see Big Hero 6 and you go, what is Big Hero 6? Like I've never heard of Big Hero 6. And so, you know, that film is slated for release in 2014, which it's interesting that the two 2014 or at least two of the 2014 outputs from Disney are Guardians of the Galaxy, which no one had really heard about, and Big Hero 6, which no one had really heard about. But the origin of Big Hero 6 is that it was a Marvel comic published in the 90s and some obscure characters, but characters that did find their way into that film. Created the writer, in terms of the creative team, was Steven T. Siegel, not to be confused with Steven Seagal, but Steven T. Siegel. Steven T. Siegel, who now is best known for being part of Man of Action Studios, which produced cartoons like Ben 10, but also produced the Big Hero 6 2D animated series that found its way to Disney XD after the film. So, yeah, I think Disney looked at, you know, a lot of the properties that Marvel might have had, saw, you know, the characters that Marvel Studios actually owned that you know, maybe they weren't owned by a different studio. And they also said, like, oh, this is a cool idea. The cast is pretty diverse. You know, there's a lot of potential in terms of just the animation style. And so they adapted that story of Hero and Baymax and the rest of the team. And I think, you know, that's a standout film for me. I think it gets lost in the Disney Animation Studios. It's just right after things like Frozen. And I think it's maybe right before, somewhere in there with Wreck-It Ralph. And so
Disney Animation Studios, I think, is doing really strong work. I think they're holding their own with Pixar, especially as of late. And so something where they haven't capitalized on that franchise of Big Hero 6 in, you know, movies. We've seen the continuation in the 2D animated series on Disney XD, and we've seen the newer Baymax series on Disney Plus. But I am hoping that we see, you know, more of those characters. We got to meet Baymax a couple times when we've been to the Disney parks. Right. So I think that is a character that resonates. Honeydew was my daughter's favorite for the longest time. So I think those characters, you know, once they're pushed to prominence a little bit more, I think could really resonate. And, you know, it seems like they're trying to maybe figure some of that out with the Disney Plus stuff. And
Oh, for sure. I
think all of those are just little test runs of, all right, the Baymax, you know, the Baymax series did well. Okay, what more do we want to do with this? Do we want to bring those characters back? So an interesting way of Disney mining some of that IP early, you know, taking something that, you know, there's this theory that they shouldn't remake good movies. They should remake bad movies.
Make them better.
Yeah, the original iteration of Big Hero 6 didn't really make a splash. But I think when you look at those characters and the archetypes and the potential they have,
oh, for sure,
that's when you can kind of expand upon them. And you see Marvel and Disney do the same thing with Guardians of the Galaxy. Granted, those are characters that had been done well enough, but, you know, were not popular and didn't have a lot of stories told about them. So,
no.
You know, I think that's Disney finding out where they're fitting these characters in and how they're fitting characters.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Guardians of the Galaxy, because they are kind of that Cinderella story, if I can say that, of like the Marvel backlog, I guess we'll say. We're like, they found them, they put them into the MCU where they fit really well, and now they have a brand new ride. Well, they have a ride at both American parks, and they've been integrated kind of across the whole the company. So that's a good one. And it would be nice to see Big Hero 6 kind of get more credit, because it is a great movie and it's had some great spinoffs.
Yeah, I think you know, you look at Figment, and you know, if STEM or STEAM is big in schools, and it also seems like it's big in Disney, you have, what is it, Wayne Szalinski, you have the Robin Williams professor from Flubber.
Right.
Throw like Tony Stark, Bruce Banner, Hero, like throw all their, like, there was one more that I was trying to think of.
In the Imagination Pavilion there. The Imagination Institute.
Yeah, just throw all of, and I know that's some of what maybe the web slingers in...
Oh, yeah.
In Avengers Campus does, of like, hey, let's recognize a lot of these, you know, genius scientist characters. But I think, again, throw Hero and throw, again, they have a bunch of scientist characters. There's one I think that's egregious that I'm missing. But throw some of these scientist characters for a little Figment. I think, you know, Figment is on this line where it has a lot of great stuff about it, but I think in terms of what Figment is, I think give it an update, but keep it Figment.
So put Figment in the MCU. No. Could be cool.
No,
I'm just...
You know, yeah, it could. Yeah, somehow. Well, here's the thing is, once we get to the X-Men, Kitty Pryde, who is one of the X-Men characters, she has a purple dragon that... I want to say is named Lockheed.
Okay.
Don't quote me on that. But she has a little purple dragon that's like her pet. And so...
Could we commandeer Figment into this? No.
That might be something where, you know, in Captain Marvel, I want to say the cat's either called Chewie or Goose.
Goose is in the movie version.
Goose is in the movie, so I think it's Chewie in the... It might be Chewie in the comics.
Okay.
So that could be something where if Peter Quill is all about Epcot wants to take the Guardians there, maybe Kitty Pryde is like, oh, it's a purple dragon. Where have I seen a purple dragon before when my parents took me to Disney?
And it's
Figment.
Figment. That would be pretty awesome. I think really cool.
I think you would, you know, some people would be mad, but it's
Everyone's going to... Yeah.
you know, and the Captain Marvel's cat thing is maybe a little bit less, but again, that's where you...
I'm all for it.
And yeah, you get, you know, Beast or, you know, Hank McCoy is in the Imagination Institute or whatever it's called. Like, I think that's when you get all these, you know, what is the new version of the Imagination Institute? And I think that's also where you can maybe, you know, low-key bring in those new characters that are otherwise owned by Universal. You know, you can get in... I'm always interested to see... It'd be interested to see those documents of, like, who owns...
Who can do what with what characters kind of thing.
Yeah, because, like, well, do they have the X-Men? Is that all the X-Men? Or could they do Kitty Pryde? I know a lot of the Marvel Comics writers were kind of told not to invent new characters when Fox and Marvel were kind of you know, at each other's throats in terms of movie rights. So, you know, that would be another interesting thing. Do we create a new character that's going to be owned by Universal in terms of parks rights? Or
it's a tangled web,
of, you know, a nice binder of all of the characters that fall under that deal. But Disney's got what they got, and they'll do with that what they will.
For sure. No, you just opened my mind to something pretty awesome. That would be really cool. I want to get into another. So we talked about kind of those lesser known characters getting their day in the Marvel sun, I guess we'll say, or in the Disney, their day in the Disney sun. But probably the most famous Marvel character that Disney has had some trouble with along the ways. I know you have you mentioned earlier about Disney kind of having the animation rights to most things, and Spider-Man is probably that most famous character, and Disney has the animation rights, and they've made this new show for preschoolers and like the kindergarten crowd called Spidey and His Amazing Friends. I do have a theory about Spidey and these amazing friends that I'm sure I want to talk about with you. I may have talked about it with you before. But I want you to kind of tell us about, because in Spidey and His Amazing Friends, there's like three spider people, I guess I'll say.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously with 2016's Captain America Civil War, that's when we bring Spider-Man to the MCU. But I think since Spider-Man 2, the Sam Raimi film, which is, I think, still one of the best pieces of Spider-Man content, period, Into the Spider-Verse is the, you know, much more contemporary highlight.
Yes.
And Into the Spider-Verse pulls from a number of different stories to bring these different spider people together. Obviously, Miles Morales, who originated in the Ultimate Universe, is the main character. We also have Gwen Stacy as Ghost Spider, who originated from a crossover called The Spider-Verse. She was introduced in a book, I believe, called Edge of Spider-Verse.
Okay.
And you bring in a couple of others, Spider-Man Noir, Penny Parker, who's like with the spider robot, and Spider-Pig.
Spider-Ham, yes. Which, John Mulaney.
Which had been, he'd been around for a longer time than most of those other characters, but into this, and obviously Peter Parker from a different universe, but a little bit, you know, more disenfranchised than some of the other Peter Parkers that we had seen. And so they bring all these characters together. And yeah, like you said, Marvel owns the animation rights to those characters. Miles Morales showed up in Ultimate Spider-Man, voiced by Donald Glover, which was some, you know, nice fan casting that they had called for pre-Andrew Garfield Spider-Man.
Okay.
But yeah, they pull in Miles, Gwen, and Peter as a trio, as Spidey and His Amazing Friends. Gwen is Ghost Spider. Peter is the titular Spider-Man. And just for a lack of confusion on children's parts, they go, well, there's not two Spider-Men. There's Spider-Man, Peter Parker, and Spin, which is Miles Morales. Not something I necessarily agree with, because, you know, I think that Miles should have equal standing as Spider-Man. Right. Sometimes he's in a different universe, sometimes he's in the same universe, but, you know, for toy rights and for, you know, clarity, I think that's fine. And then kids will figure it out. And I can guarantee, you know, probably 5 or 6 years down the line, it will be Miles Morales as the MCU Spider-Man.
That would be really cool.
So, yeah. And, you know, you have other newer characters show up on Spidey and His Amazing Friends, characters like Kamala Khan, Miss Marvel. Amadeus Cho, who is a legacy Hulk character. He's the Hulk on Spidey and his Amazing Friends. T'Challa, Black Panther shows up, and we get some other holdovers from Into the Spider-Verse, like a female Doc Ock, and some, you know, different takes on some of the Marvel villains. I know season two is going to bring Tony Stark in, voiced by John Stamos, who is a Disney fanatic. And,
right.
You know, we get some nice crossover there. But I think it's a nice way of introducing kids to those characters. There's been a number of different Spidey animated shows produced by Disney, but bringing your 3- and 4-year-olds in, 5-year-olds into that world, introducing them to the characters. The conflicts are all very light. You know, it might be, you know, Green Goblin makes a robot that looks like Peter and Gwen's like favorite cartoon character, and or you know, the Rhino steals some bubble gum and it explodes because it's science bubble gum. So, you know, the stories are all pretty light, but yeah, you want to, it is that kind of corporate mindset of how do we hook them young.
Of course.
And I think Spider-Man is a very easy way to do that. Very recognizable character, and I think it's still very well done from my perspective.
Nice.
So that's, and what's your, I know,
yeah,
you have a theory in how Disney is, you know, of again course, being very strategic on their own terms how to be successful.
Your kids are younger and you've watched more Spidey and His Amazing Friends than I have. My kids are a little older and they had the PJ Masks, which was on Disney Junior. It was the biggest thing for the years that it was on Disney Junior, but it's not fully a Disney property. It was just on Disney Junior. And it, for a time, it was the best, like the most popular show, the biggest selling show on Disney, and like on Disney Junior. And it wasn't making that money for the company as if it was like their own property. So I've seen a lot of connections between PJ Masks and Spidey and His Amazing Friends. And I just wondered if you can see where I'm coming from with that, or if there's any legitimacy to my theory.
Yeah, I think, again, that's where Disney is scratching that itch. But, you know, Disney, I think in the dynamics with Sony and who owns what, I think it was maybe either with Civil War and that transition for Spidey or Amazing Spider-Man that they really pulled over the... And Amazing Spider-Man also would have been the first Spider-Man film produced after the acquisition of Marvel. So I think, okay, you know, they're looking at, well, as we're re-signing this deal, as you're making another Spider-Man film, we keep the merchandise rights, we keep the animation rights from Sony. And, you know, that's where, again, they're saying, what can we do with this character?
Right.
PJ Masks is kind of where they're going, well, we can't make money off
of leaving it on the table, yeah.
Maybe we're making a cut of advertising, but this isn't something we're producing. And they're going, well, what can we do? I don't think that the Spider-Man shows, like Ultimate Spider-Man and just the regular Marvel Spider-Man, I don't think they've made very many waves. I know my kid loves Ghost Spider, and we've looked for Ghost Spider as she's shown up on those shows.
Yeah.
But I don't know, you know, it's kind of in a weird spot where I don't know if older elementary kids, younger middle school kids might be into that. You know, I think they might just go, well, I'm just going to watch the movies. I'm just going to watch Spider-Verse.
Sure.
And they kind of ignore that, where I think maybe they're going, we're finding more success with the younger kids and these superhero shows. So I think it's, again, where they're finding that itch. It is the same thing, I think, with a lot of those Fox characters, where they're going, okay, you know, can now, you know, one of the first things that they can do with the X-Men characters is bringing back the cartoon.
Oh, right. Right.
Because, you know, X-Men is going to be an interesting thing, because I don't think it's existed in kids' minds for very long. I think if you asked your two kids,
no,
you know, who are some of the X-Men, they wouldn't know.
I think they would know Wolverine, but that's about the extent.
Yeah, so I think that's where they're in an interesting spot of, how do we introduce kids to these characters, because they haven't been around, and you know, I'm sure you'd go to Target and get an X-Men doll, but I think that's going to be a harder. I think they're going to be realizing they're going to have to introduce these Fox characters to a younger generation.
yeah,
in a way that they didn't have to do for Spider-Man. But also, you know, you think about Marvel and they've launched several characters. You know, Black Panther wasn't out there a lot. Guardians of the Galaxy is the biggest example. And they're doing really well on. And they said, oh, well, here's a Baby Groot. And I think, you know, kids as young as one or two can see Baby Groot as like, you know, the doll and you know, just this cute little thing that also kind of operates without any kind of language. It's all based on visual storytelling. So it's, you know, in terms of, I don't want to call it indoctrination of children, but in terms of hooking kids on these characters, they need to, you know, they're going to have to do some heavy lifting with X-Men and Fantastic Four.
Yeah, no, for sure. That's a good way, you know, bringing those in. When you talked about X-Men, it reminded me of, like, you know, we talked about the X-Men cartoon show from the 90s and that being very kind of a big pop cultural moment for, you know, people our age. And then when, by the time in the 2000s, when the movies came out, I know I was still buying action figures for the X-Men when that movie came out. I was familiar with the characters, with the story, Professor X, Magneto, all of it. And I was really excited for the movie. I know we went to see it the first day it came out, but I had already known that this character's the whole story from watching that show earlier on. So even though there was a break between the two, I was already primed to see those Fox movies. And they were big, and there were a lot of them. I didn't see all of them, but the early ones, I definitely went to the theater and saw those. And I want to talk about the theater next, because we've got a lot of new big movies that are coming soon. And even though we've been talking all around the MCU and the movies and all that stuff, we've been talking about the comic books, too, a lot with comic books. And I want to kind of go through some of the upcoming things that may be less familiar to fans who maybe just are into the MCU for the movies, haven't read the comics, and have you weigh in and let us kind of know where that might come from in the comics. What's the story behind this? Because as we said earlier, a lot of these MCU movies come from like the comic book canon and what those big stories were in the comics. So I'm going to go one by one and kind of give you a few. And then we'll talk through each of these. Yeah. So the first one that's coming up is Secret Invasion, which I remember hearing the name from comic books, but I never read any sort of Secret Invasion stuff. So what is Secret Invasion in the comic world to prep us for what's coming in the shows and movies?
Yeah. So, you know, when we were talking about Joe Quesada coming in and saving Marvel in a lot of ways and bringing them out of bankruptcy, his big thing was, how do we save the Avengers? And Brian Michael Bendis, who had kind of exploded into the Marvel world with Ultimate Spider-Man, revamps that character for the Marvel comics, especially when that first film is coming out. He's sitting down and he's saying, well, let's look at the Avengers. This is like our crown jewel. And at that point, they kind of had like some third, fourth stringers on the Avengers. And okay. So he starts off his business being, well, who should be on the Avengers? We should have the best of the best. We need Captain America and Iron Man. I think Thor was maybe dead at the time.
Okay.
But they brought in Spider-Man. They brought in Luke Cage. They brought in Wolverine. And then I believe they had some other characters like maybe Spider-Woman.
Okay.
And there's a couple of others that I'm forgetting. But I think the idea behind Brian Michael Bendis's Avengers was, this needs to be our best characters. This needs to be, you know, our flagship book.
Okay.
And so you get probably, I think, 20 or 30 issues into Brian Michael Bendis's run when a character shows up and they are killed. But as they're killed, their body turns into a Skrull. Now, if you recall, we saw the Skrulls. They're shape-shifting aliens. We saw them in Captain Marvel. You know, their big thing is, they could be masquerading as anybody, and you really have to know the person to really trust them. And you know, a Skrull who's impersonating someone might mess up a detail, but they are these. They can be anyone. They can look like anyone. And so, Secret Invasion was a book where, oh, we just found a dead body, and it turned into a Skrull. Well, now I don't know who to trust. if this person who I thought was themselves ended up being a Skrull, anybody could be a Skrull. So this idea of paranoia and who do I trust, and you could be a Skrull, and you know, how well do you know the person that you're impersonating, became a big crossover story in Marvel Comics. So the Skrull Empire, which was a very religiously inclined Skrull Empire, wanted to take over Earth, felt that, you know, Earth was part of their kind of religious crusade. They had impersonated a number of key Marvel characters, mainly Sue Richards, and I believe there were a couple others, but they tried to stay away from the big characters for the most part.
Okay.
And yeah, just playing on kind of like a Red Scare paranoia. Do I trust you? Are you who you say you are? And so I think that will not look the same way it did in the comics, because in the comics it was a big crossover event where you saw all of the Avengers tie-in books with all of the other characters. I think it's going to be much smaller. So we might see Nick Fury and Maria Hill, so who we've seen with interact with Skrulls. We'll probably see a couple of other characters that they can manage that are maybe like B or C list who will show up on those Disney Plus shows. But we'll mainly see Skrull characters and how they're trying to infiltrate
Earth
in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So again, when we look at these big titles and we see that they're big crossover books or crossover events that involve all these main characters, you got to hamper your expectations and go, it will be the you know, skeleton of that story, but it's not going to be the same.
They're going to change it. But it does sound like there's a good opportunity to get some of those kind of up-and-coming characters, since we've kind of got a new MCU now after Endgame, to kind of get some more screen time and some more bigger parts to become more integral.
Yeah, exactly. You know, look at these titles. Like, for instance, we'll talk about a couple of titles that have been stolen from books in a second, but Age of Ultron, the second Avengers film, got its name from a Brian Michael Bendis crossover story, and it doesn't really resemble that story, but, you know, a strong title and drive sales back to that book when the movie comes out. So, you know, they know what they're doing, and I think fans at this point know, or should know, don't expect that same story when you go to the theater. So, and also, the Secret Invasion gives us one of the final pieces of the Young Avengers puzzle. Now, I'm not sure if you are familiar with Young Avengers.
Not at all.
There's been a couple of different iterations, but some of that team is comprised of legacy characters like Cassie Lang, who is Scott Lang, Ant-Man's daughter.
Okay.
Kate Bishop, the Hawkeye we met on
Hawkeye. Yep.
Iron Lad, who is a version of Kang, the Conqueror.
Oh, okay.
Asgardian, who is Billy Kaplan, or Billy, who is Wanda Maximoff's son.
Oh, yeah.
Patriot, who is the grandson of Isaiah Bradley, who we met in Falcon and the Winter Soldier. And then a couple of other characters here and there. There's a kid, Loki. So we saw a child or a kid version of Loki on the show. So they're kind of got all the pieces to do a Young Avengers book based on some of the characters that we've seen. And the final character that we haven't met as of yet, in terms of at least the original crew, is Hulkling. Which is a teenage version of the Hulk, who's actually, I believe, half Skrull and half Kree. And Kree was the alien race that Carol Danvers was training with and carrying out missions with in the first Captain Marvel film. So,
gotcha.
He potentially could show up in Secret Invasion, and I think that's maybe Feige's big plan for the Disney Plus shows, is that eventually we are going to have Young Avengers. I think that's just a matter of time before we hear that announcement, maybe at D23 in a month or so.
Right, coming up soon. All right, another one I want to talk about. So that gives us a lot to look forward to with Secret Invasion. But another one I want to talk about is one that's actually been made into a movie and a pretty popular character, and that's Blade. So Blade got the movie early on, but I'm not too familiar with the comic book of Blade. And does Blade fit into the MCU? Where would Blade even fit kind of into the MCU? I'm familiar with the movie, but not the comics.
So Blade was, you know, a lot of people look at that first X-Men film, produced in some way by Kevin Feige, directed by Bryan Singer, who, you know, is extradited from Hollywood and for appropriate reasons. But Blade was like the first. Blade was the first truly successful Marvel adaptation. And I think a lot of times it gets, you know, swept under the rug or forgotten. But I think it's a phenomenal adaptation of the character, taking someone who had this really clear crossover appeal. He's a guy who hunts vampires. Vampire stories, you know, I think are always present and probably will be. But Wesley Snipes as Blade, you know, has a trilogy of films, but no one produced anything with that character for a good period of time. Those films were produced by New Line Cinema, which is now part of Warner Brothers. And so those rights eventually reverted back to Marvel. So I think they're going, well, how can we make a Blade film? Blade was recently put on the comics roster as an Avenger. He was in the mainline book as an Avenger. And so I think they're trying to fit in, who is this guy? Maybe we can introduce vampires as part of the MCU mythology. The end credits scene for Eternals seems to, you know, hint at the Kit Harington character, who's the Black Knight, maybe being associated with Blade in some capacity.
Okay.
But I think that scratches the itch of some of the supernatural in the Marvel Universe. You know, vampires in the Marvel Universe, lower street level stuff, maybe a little bit grittier in what is usually a funnier, lighter universe. And I think just bringing in a great character. You know, Blade doesn't have a lot of great stories told about him. He's introduced in stories in which he's kind of in conjunction or in conflict with Michael Morbius, who we just saw a film being released. And Morbius was actually supposed to be in the first Blade film, I believe at the end, but he was cut. And so, you know, maybe if there's ever any synergy between the Sony and Marvel universes that we see that, I think that's not going to happen. But, you know, Blade, my hope for that is when Blade, the film comes out, we get a little bit more attention on Blade, the comics character, and maybe he gets his own book. And I know they were trying to do a lot of different things with Blade that just didn't happen. So Mahershala Ali, Oscar winner for Moonlight, is playing. I think, you know, I think that's great casting, and I'm looking forward to that, but I don't know. It might be like kind of a Shang-Chi thing where there's a little bit of connection, but largely it's his own thing, and he'll get integrated soon enough. And he's got powers. It's not like he's Hawkeye where, you know, he's just a guy with a bow and arrow.
Right.
But he's got like vampire powers. So he'll be able to hold his own in a big scuffle.
Nice. All right. Mm-hmm. So that's another one to look forward to. The next one here, I have no clue what this is. Thunderbolts is coming up in spring of 2024.
So Thunderbolts hits on this concept, I believe in the early 90s they were introduced, and they were kind of, Marvel and DC are always in this back and forth where DC creates a character and Marvel has their version. Marvel has a character and DC has that version.
Yeah.
You know, there's Black Cat in the Marvel universe and there's Catwoman. Darkseid and Thanos are very similar.
Oh, for sure.
We have Hawkeye and Green Arrow. And so there's a lot of overlap. 1980s, John Ostrander creates the Suicide Squad for DC Comics.
Okay.
All of these kind of, you know, low-level villains who get recruited by the government. And, you know, if you carry out this mission, you get a get-out-of-jail-free card. Or if you, you know, something happens to you. Thunderbolts is very similar to Suicide Squad, but it was a team of villains who were kind of repackaged as a team of heroes, led by Baron Zemo, who we've seen played by Daniel Brühl in Captain America Civil War, and most recently Falcon and the Winter Soldier. And so I think we have the pieces for some of the Thunderbolts. Allegra De Fontina, who is played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, she's shown up in a Black Widow end credit scene. She's shown up in Captain America and the Winter Soldier, or Falcon and the Winter Soldier, recruiting John Walker, the U.S. agent. And so I think we'll see a couple of those characters, plus maybe some other villain characters show up as the government sanctioned version of the Avengers. So I think, again, a group of either anti-heroes, people who aren't clear-cut, you know, heroes, be joining the Thunderbolts as a group of heroes that the government can more easily control, where, you know, certainly the Avengers were in cahoots with S.H.I.E.L.D. S.H.I.E.L.D. is now destroyed and potentially brought back again, but then, you know, it's a little hazy in its standing in the universe, but Avengers kind of seemed like their own thing. U.S. government definitely wants their own version. So that'll be Thunderbolts. Sometimes okay. villain, sometimes not, but not the most admirable people in those positions.
Yeah. Gotcha. That'll be an interesting one to see, and to see who they kind of assemble for that group, pardon the pun there, as it comes up will be interesting. All right, the next one I want to talk about is kind of one of those Marvel flagship properties that the MCU has barely touched a little bit with the Multiverse of Madness, but not really gotten into it yet, and that's the Fantastic Four. There've been movies, there've been, you know, comics forever for this one, and the MCU hasn't gotten too much of it. So what do you think the Fantastic Four will be for us?
Yeah, so, you know, there's been a couple of things. We've certainly seen John Krasinski play Mr. Fantastic in the Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. I don't think he's going to reprise that role. I think that might be a one and done. I hope that's a one and done.
Gotcha. You hope he's a variant.
Yes, that he's a variant. And there's a couple things that have been hinted both in and out of the film. So one, Doctor Strange makes a joke about the Fantastic Four of like, oh, didn't you guys chart in the 60s? So potentially hinting at something similar to Captain Marvel, where the Fantastic Four existed in the 60s of the Marvel Universe. Maybe they weren't seen as superheroes, or maybe they were seen as celebrities. They existed in some capacity, and maybe they disappeared since the 60s. That would be a fine way. I don't necessarily, you know, love that idea, but it's maybe cleaner than just introducing them from the get-go. Kevin Feige has said outside of, you know, film narrative that the new upcoming film is not going to be an origin story. The origin story for the Fantastic Four is quick. He's a scientist, Reed Richards. He gets his girlfriend. He gets his girlfriend's brother. He gets his friend who's a pilot. They steal a space shuttle. They go up into space. They get zapped. They come back. They have powers. They become a team like that. It's pretty quick, and you could do that either in the opening credits, which would be cool,
or just
I think you tell it in some capacity. You know, they haven't, I guess they've had as many iterations as Peter Parker, and so we never saw Peter Parker's origin story in the Tom Holland version, but I think definitively, I think you tell that story quickly in snippets and then move on. Even the Edward Norton Incredible Hulk hints at and steals some stuff from the Bill Bixby, Lou Ferrigno Incredible Hulk show to kind of retell some of the story, but also, you know, wants to tell its own thing without having to spend 30 to 40 minutes to a whole movie explaining who this character is in terms of their origin story. So, all right, we know it might be set in the 60s. We know it might not be an origin story. I know Peyton Reed, who directed all three of the Ant-Man films, Ant-Man and the Wasp, Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania. He, before any of those Ant-Man films, was going to direct the Fantastic Four movie for Fox. It was going to be set in the 60s. It was going to be a period piece. Mm. He was looking at people like George Clooney to play Reed Richards, I believe like Charlize Theron to play Sue Richards. But his previous film, before he was going to produce and direct Fantastic Four, was a film set in the 60s called Down With Love, starring Ewan McGregor and Renee Zellweger. The studio loved it. It was a flop. And since it was a flop, I think they said, maybe you're not our Fantastic Four guy.
Okay.
I think, based on his love for that franchise, the Fantastic Four, and what he's already doing with Marvel and how he works really well in the Marvel system, I think Peyton Reed would be a good pick to direct Fantastic Four. Now, my theory of what that story could be and how it leads into other things starts with how we saw Reed Richards in Doctor Strange. Reed okay. Richards introduces this idea of a multiverse incursion as he's speaking to Doctor Strange. An incursion is when there is such nonsense happening in the multiverse that two universes in the multiverse crash okay. into each other, resulting in the destruction of either one of those universes or both of those universes. So really bad stuff, cataclysmic event caused by people meddling in the multiverse, which seems to be what's happening a lot. And that's the saga that we're in, the multiverse yeah. saga. So I think part of the Fantastic Four film is Reed Richards trying to deal with an incursion. Now, where it might find its root in the comics is Jonathan Hickman, who is a pretty prolific Marvel writer. He just revamped the X-Men pretty recently. Probably about 7 or 8 years ago, he revamped the Fantastic Four. And where it started, the initial premise was one of the things that Reed Richards wanted to do was solve everything. He wanted to fix everything. He wanted to have the ultimate okay. fix for all of the world's problems. He's thinking big picture. Reed Richards is naturally very egotistical. He doesn't trust anybody. He's locking himself in a room and trying to do this by himself. He realizes this is a Herculean task, and eventually he stumbles upon a multiverse council of other Reed Richards, the Council of Reeds, if you will. Gotcha. And so that's where this ego kind of expands, and he goes, well, I want to solve this. I'm so smart, I don't trust anyone else other than me to solve this, so I'm going to get a multiverse council of me's to help me solve everything. Now, the big end game, no pun intended, but for the big end point for this saga is an Avengers Kang Dynasty and an Avengers Secret War. Now, the thing about Kang, who seems to be the main villain for the multiverse saga, we met him in Loki, a version of him. He's going to be an Ant-Man, and I think that he is going to be the main villain of the multiverse saga. Part of his origin is that he is a descendant, you know, maybe in the year 3000, but he is a descendant of Reed Richards.
Okay. Oh.
I think Kang eventually shows up in, you know, maybe the Fantastic Four does a similar story. Reed is trying to solve the incursion. He doesn't trust anybody but himself. He finds a multiverse council of Reeds. Or Reed Richards or Richards' descendants, and he sees Kang. He meets Kang. And Kang tricks him. Kang uses Reed Richards' own ego against him. He says, I'll help you solve this incursion that's coming. I will help you prevent this incursion coming. But he tricks Reed into causing an incursion. And so when this incursion comes, that's when all of the multiverses, because it seems like we got a big mess of multiverses that are happening.
Oh, yeah.
Spider-Man No Way Home and Doctor Strange and Loki. And I think there's still a couple of other things that, and What If? I think there's a big mess of the multiverse. And when Kang tricks Reed Richards into causing an incursion, it explodes the entire multiverse. And I think Kang picks up the pieces and rebuilds it in his own image. And that's where I think we at least get that first Avengers film, Kang Dynasty, is as the multiverse has exploded and Kang has kind of handpicked the pieces that he likes to rebuild his own version of the multiverse of the universe, that's where we get the Kang Dynasty. Eventually, the Avengers are going to have to deal with that, and I think that's where we get into Secret Wars. So I don't know, maybe maybe Kang is putting, you know, incursions into effect in Kang Dynasty, and Secret Wars is maybe the product of that. Kang Dynasty is a story I'm not necessarily familiar with, but I think that's just much more so than anything we saw in Infinity War and Endgame. I think that's where we just see the villain won, and what does this world look like for a better part of a movie. Now, Secret Wars, where everything ends up, is Kang has rebuilt the multiverse in his image, and what does a world look like that's built, you know, a composite of all these different multiverses? to go back to the Fantastic Four and Jonathan Hickman, there are two stories that are called Secret Wars. One is from the 1980s. That was basically a Marvel Comics toy tie-in with, I believe, Kenner Toys, in which Kenner Toys was going to produce Marvel action figures. Marvel wanted to do something that was synergistic in terms of writing a story that could connect to that toy line. They did a focus group with a bunch of kids, and the two words that kids liked best for the title were Secret and Wars.
Really? That's kind of awesome.
And so Secret Wars is pretty much just a big, it's like a 12-issue series that is basically just a big advertisement for toys. If you've ever seen, you know, any commercial for toys and action figures in the 90s or the 80s, where a kid is just playing with his action figures and mashing them up, that's kind of what Secret Wars is. I know Dr. Doom, you know, is involved in a big villain way. He's not the main villain, but he kind of takes advantage. Okay. But, you know, all of the Marvel heroes and villains are sent to a battle world in which they need to fight. And again, it's very much a kid playing with action figures.
Like a pile of action figures.
You know, that's where we mainly get the introduction of the alien symbiote, the black costume for Spider-Man, Venom, is that what springs out of Secret Wars. But that is not going to be, I think, where the film Secret Wars, Avengers Secret Wars, takes its inspiration. Jonathan Hickman in 2015 did a revamped version of Secret Wars. Tied into his Reed Richards and Fantastic Four run, eventually there was going to be an incursion in the Marvel Comics universe. Jonathan Hickman wrote Fantastic Four. He wrote Avengers, and Avengers led right into Secret Wars. Is Dr. Doom and a couple of other characters took advantage of the incursion that was happening when the multiverse exploded. Basically, Doom was the one, not Kang. Doom was the one who rebuilt the multiverse in his image. Reed Richards was not part of that universe. He was married to Sue Richards. The Richards children were his kids, Doom's children. Okay. He made Johnny Storm into the son of the universe. He made Ben Grimm, the Thing, into like a big rock wall dividing parts of the universe. And his universe was called Battle World. And it was different multiverses. Okay. Imagine just a planet made up of different universes. So they had their main Secret Wars book, and then they also had tie-in books that were stories told in each of these different multiverses.
Okay.
And so I think that's where maybe we can bring in the Fox characters, Wesley Snipes' Blade, get into other multiversal things. So eventually, Reed Richards and Dr. Doom need to fight, and that results in a, you know, not a new battle world, but a cleaner version of the Marvel Universe in which, you know, certain characters from other universes are brought into the main Marvel Universe, particularly Miles Morales, who started in a different universe, brought into the main universe. So I think, again, that story can potentially be very similar to the comics version, the film version, but maybe swap out Kang for Dr. Doom, and that would be a very similar story. So again, starting, you know, we started a little bit in Doctor Strange. It'll lead not nicely into Fantastic Four, go into the Kang Dynasty, go into Secret Wars, and there might be a couple of other stops in other films, but I think, again, they're trying to do something big, and, you know, it's not going to look the exact same as some of those comic stories, but I think that's the big move, is Kang versus... It could be Kang versus Doctor Strange. Doctor Strange seems like their main character, but I think, you know, introduce Kang first, then introduce Reed Richards, and you get Reed Richards versus Kang for the you know, future of the multiverse.
And also,
I think what Secret Wars affords Marvel is a nice, clean exit. It allows them to restart. It allows them to refresh a little bit. You know, when you're talking about multiversal stuff and alternate universes, I think that gives them, you know, 17 years after the original beginning, after Iron Man, it gives them a 17-year franchise in which they say, what are we going to keep? What are we going to retain? What are we going to jettison? how do we move forward for the next 17 years of this story, you know? And so I think it gives them a nice clean opportunity to bring in characters like the mutants and the X-Men. Because I don't think we'll see X-Men until after the multiverse saga. I think you can very easily go from the multiverse saga into the mutant saga. Because I think the mutants are... they existed as their own cinematic universe. And I think that's Kevin Feige's White Whale. It's one of the first comic book movies that he started on as a producer or an associate producer or, you know, someone, a low level producer. But I think that's his White Whale, much more so than Fantastic Four. I think Kevin Feige is like, what can I really do with the X-Men? And there's hundreds of characters and dozens of storylines to pull from for the X-Men. So
it's a big story.
Looking at some of their slate that they announced at San Diego Comic-Con, I think it looks like they're picking the bones a little bit. You know, I'm excited for characters like Riri Williams, Ironheart to show up, you know, a couple of other things that are announced. But, you know, when you're getting characters like Echo, who I like, I don't know if they weren't their own series, or Agatha, who, again, I think there's potential, but it's interesting that's who they're pushing forward. I think when I'm not necessarily excited about Agatha, Coven of Chaos on Disney Plus, I think Marvel's trick is always, we're giving you an Agatha story, but here's how it ties into the larger thing. I think that's
how it's part of the bigger picture.
It's always bigger picture where they're saying, we're taking this opportunity of a breakout character from one thing, and how do we expand that into a bigger story? It's never, nothing self-contained anymore. It all ties into the bigger thing. So while some of that slate looks like, oh man, they're really struggling, or this seems lower level, I think again they're using what they have for the time being. And I think the X-Men are one, I think we need some space in between. I think what the last X-Men live action was maybe 2017 or 2018. So we'll get 7-8 years in between X-Men film, which I think is necessary. But the final piece of that puzzle for Marvel and Disney is bringing X-Men back into the fold and really representing those characters as they existed in the Marvel comics. I think that's, you know, Spider-Man's been brought back. I don't think Spider-Man's ever going to leave Sony. I think Sony just sees dollar signs a little bit too much.
Oh, yeah.
They're bending over backwards to build their own Sony universe, it seems like, with a couple of tie-ins. They're doing Morbius and Venom and Kraven the Hunter and Madame Web, and they're doing the best they can. But yeah, the final piece, at least for now, is X-Men being brought in. And like I said, I think that's going to be its own saga of, you bring this cast of characters in, how do they fit in with this pre-existing Marvel universe? And it's something I'm excited for. I'm hoping they don't botch, and I don't necessarily think they will. So, yeah.
Nice. So yeah, so Marvel does, like you said, they do a good job of thinking big picture and then kind of jumbling things up. We saw in the Infinity Saga, and then smoothing it out. And I want to thank you for helping me smooth out some of these Marvel things that I didn't necessarily know too much about. And give us maybe a little bit more context of what we got to look forward to. So yeah, thanks so much for coming on to talk Marvel with me.
Of course, yeah, my pleasure.
So Adam, where can people find you online if they want to hear some more?
Yeah, sure. So it hasn't been updated too recently, but I do have a YouTube series called Can I Teach It? Which is a show that explores the teachability of pop culture across media. I am a teacher by trade, and part of my passions as a teacher is bringing in pop culture in the best way into my classroom. So I have this YouTube series in which I take a piece of media and I explore if you could teach it, how you would teach it, and should you teach it. So, you know, I've done a couple of Disney things. I've done the Loki series from Disney Plus. I've done WandaVision, and I'm planning potentially a Ms. Marvel episode. But, you know, looking at this content and going, what is something where we could tie what this content is doing into, you know, some necessary skills practice that's naturally going to be found in a classroom. So again, Can I Teach It? Look for that WandaVision or Loki episode on YouTube, and be sure to like, share, and subscribe.
Nice. All right. So yeah, thanks again for coming on, and thank you to everyone who's listening. If you want to find me online, you could find me on Twitter at Eric H. Synergy. You could find me on Instagram and Facebook at Synergy Loves Company. And then, of course, SynergyLovesCompany.com, where you could find all of those things in the podcast and everything. So until next time, activate your Synergy machine, and we'll see you later.